Welcome to episode 38, our All Movie Talk episode for June 19th, 2007. And our episode this week starts with a talk about The Blacklist, the Hollywood Blacklist during the McCarthy era in the 50s. Then we'll follow it with our trivia question, as always, and jump straight into our top six list about rock and roll movies. And wrapping things up, we'll have a director's spotlight on Hayao Miyazaki, a Japanese animator sometimes called the greatest living animator. That's coming up on All Movie Talk. I am Sam Stoddard.
And Sam, this is normally the part where Steven would chime in and say who he is, make some lame joke, that kind of thing. This week, however, I've replaced him. My name is not Steven Keller. It's a different name that's not an alias, because the powers that be have blacklisted Steven Keller from this podcast on account of his distinctly bad taste in movies. So he's been replaced with me, the guy that's not Steven Keller but sounds very similar to him, and I assure you it's not an alias at all. We talked recently about the Hollywood studio system that sort of sprung up at the end of the 1920s and ran through the late 40s, early 50s. And I want to talk this week about one of the sort of bad things that really resulted from a few companies having so much control over the entire entertainment business. And something that sort of comes right at the end of this time period, too. And it's the Hollywood Blacklist, the sort of name for the sort of unofficial, sort of official list of people who are simply not allowed to work in the industry because they were either actual or suspected communists. Now, this is always such a strange thing to think about because it seems so alien today that this kind of thing could happen. But it goes back to right about 1947 or so, when the country had just finished fighting World War II and the Soviet Union emerged as a major international power, you know, the so-called second superpower of the world. And there was a real fear in America that communists were actively attempting to infiltrate American society and use every means that they could to overthrow the government and the entire Western order. And again, it sounds crazy now at this point in time that the society would be just riddled with spies for the Soviet Union, but this is actually what people thought. And I guess in some ways I feel like this time period has been we've been unfair to the people who kind of were really afraid of this. I had a history professor once in college who suggested that witch hunts happen essentially for two reasons. One is that there has to be something to gain. Someone in power has to be able to gain something from witch hunts, which makes sense. And then two, though, there has to actually be a few witches, a few people that are. And in fact, in the 1940s, there were a lot of people who had been communists or were communists, and some of them had been involved in some radical groups. Now, obviously, to the extent that it was that, you know, certain forces in the government made it out to be, it was way overblown. There was no real huge overwhelming conspiracy, but there was some. There were Soviet spies, just as there were Western spies in the Soviet Union. So I think we should sort of approach it from that perspective. We shouldn't necessarily be too harsh on people who made bad decisions given their times. They didn't have the same information available to them that we did, but certainly there was also some very bad things that occurred, and we're going to talk about them. So right after World War II, the United States Congress began investigating the possibility of communists trying to infiltrate the government. And this is right at the period of time that J. Edgar Hoover is running the FBI. He'd been running it for a while, and he is obsessed with wiretapping people and following anyone who might be a communist sympathizer, and the United States government's going to get involved really on an official level. Of course, the famous one is McCarthy, the senator from Wisconsin, who is going to be holding these sorts of hearings in the Senate. And in the House of Representatives, there's a committee called the House Un-American Activities Committee that is going to be pretty much investigating anyone who has done anything un-American, which is code for maybe it was a communist. And an important thing to realize is that in the 1920s and 1930s, communism wasn't quite the perceived evil that it would be in the 1940s. Again, remember that the United States was allied with the Soviet Union in World War II. These were the people who are on our side not too long ago. So the idea that, you know, communism was pretty popular among the American intellectual and the American elite in the 20s and the 30s especially. I mean, you look at the 1930s during the Great Depression, communism was popular among a lot of people because it offered a potential way to get out of that problem. But the House is going to begin investigating and calling forth people who they think are involved in this, and they become particularly obsessed with the idea that Hollywood is going to be used as a means to spread propaganda. And, I mean, in a way, this kind of makes some sense. Hollywood has always been, and the arts in general, have always been traditionally kind of dominated by more leftist-leaning people, and especially during that time. And so there are a lot of people in Hollywood who were members of various communist organizations or members of union, that kind of thing. And remember that there was a period in time where being a union member was seen as a sort of socialistic, communistic kind of thing. So if you were in one, there's a good chance that you'd be a member of the other. One of the tenets of communism, of course, is going to be the idea of unionizing and organizing labor. And so these people who were involved in it, the House calls forward a bunch of people, and it comes with this list of witnesses that it wants to investigate. And Congress has the ability to call people forward and subpoena them and put them under oath, just like a court does. And a number of these witnesses tell the Congress that they're not going to talk. They refuse to answer any questions about this. These are the so-called Hollywood Ten. In October of 1947, they're going to all refuse to speak on the grounds of their First Amendment rights. They say they have the right to associate freely with who they want to, and they don't have to tell Congress, you know, whether or not they were a member of this organization. And the real thing Congress wants is names. If you're before the committee, they already know that at one point in time you are involved with a communist organization of some sort or socialist organization. But what they're looking for is more people, because the fear, of course, is that, well, we have to find the people who are the ringleaders or the people who are really behind this. So they want you to get up there and they want you to rat on your friends, basically. You know, you can go ahead and say, yes, I was a member of the Communist Party, but I didn't know what it was and I got out of it and I apologize. And if you do that, you will find that you're able to pretty much escape a lot of things. If you're willing to pledge your loyalty to the United States government and to say, yeah, I know I dabbled with that in the 30s, but so is everyone else. But a lot of these people are willing to say, yes, I did this, but no, I will not tell you who else was part of this, because they have a right to privacy, they have the right to political activity that's not being monitored by the government, that kind of thing. And so it's really going to be, if you don't cooperate with the committee, that you're going to be in a lot of trouble. So all 10 of them go to jail for contempt of Congress, because they refuse to testify on the grounds of the First Amendment. And the courts disagree. They say you don't have a right to refuse to testify based on the First Amendment. And the two most famous of the 10, the director Edward Dimitrik and the writer Dalton Trumbo. And they're both going to become big players in what's going to ensue later on. Now, in November of that year, so just the next month, at the end of October, the Hollywood Ten go forward and refuse to testify. In November, the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association of America, and the Screen Actors Guild both take strict anti-communist stances, that they will not employ anyone who is a communist or who has communist sympathies, and they're going to require you to take loyalty oaths to America, for instance, to be a screen actor. And shortly thereafter, on November 25th, representatives from all the big studios and a couple other industry organizations meet at the Waldorf Hotel, and they come up with they try to decide, what are we going to do about this? Are we, you know, people are accusing us of being communists. Congress is talking about passing laws to regulate us. They're going to call more and more of us up. What are we going to do? And unfortunately, they decided to just fold. They've considered perhaps pursuing legal action, see what they could do, and they just say no. Straight out, we're going to completely do whatever Congress asks us to do. And again, remember, this is not Congress passing laws. This is just a committee in Congress that's calling people forward. It's not really the same thing as congressional laws that are then signed by the president to become actual law of the land. So the Waldorf statement basically says that none of the studios will work with anyone who, one, refuses to testify in front of Congress on this, and who doesn't fully comply with the congressional hearings. And if you continue to show any sort of communist activities or sympathies, you won't find a job in Hollywood. And so the Hollywood Ten are going to be the first to become blacklisted, because they just trade up publicly and very, you know, it's a big, very big media deal at the time that these people were just not going to talk to Congress. So they're all going to be denied work. So the Waldorf Statement, as it's called, is going to serve as the foundation of the blacklist. And very shortly thereafter, in 1948, the next year, all of the Hollywood Ten are going to be convicted of contempt. The Supreme Court of the United States refused to hear the appeal, and so they're all going to have to do about a year in jail. Very famously, Edward Dimitrik decided that he would talk so he could get out of jail early. He named names, and he's allowed to continue working, and he becomes, in a way, more of a prominent director after this period of time. His more famous movies are from the 50s rather than before that period of time. But a lot of them are just going to go ahead and serve out their jail terms and then not find work in Hollywood. And one of the interesting things here is that from this point on, from about 1948 through the end of the 50s, there are going to be all these various groups sort of policing it. There's never really an official blacklist. One of the things about blacklist, obviously, is that you don't necessarily publish them, but all of a sudden, if you happen to be named in one of these committees and you do not immediately try and go out and clear yourself, you're going to just find your phone no longer rings. No one wants to work with you. You can't find work. And there are also these various groups circulating blacklists. These are people, groups from, say, the American Legion to all these other anti-communist groups that sprung up throughout the country at this time, and they're going to be performing investigations. And it becomes a thing where even if you just oppose the existence of these lists, even if you were never a communist and you say, look, I think that this is wrong, you get added to the list. It's this weird sort of continual growing thing where anyone who dares to defy it is added to the list and is silenced, so everyone just kind of goes along with it.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious that it was something that touched a real nerve with people. It wasn't something you could sit down and have a logical discussion with. It was just too close to home with people, and they got very emotional rather than really thinking things through. And, of course, it's not just emotional about the politics, but emotional about, you know, how is Congress going to affect my job and my industry if we don't adopt this particular attitude about what's happening. And so it just hit people really hard at home, and that always makes people emotional about their behavior.
And not to mention, I mean, obviously, a lot of people really were genuinely afraid of communists. There was a genuine fear. I mean, I think we know today that there were definitely people who were just using this as a means to gather power for themselves, but there was also at the base of it a genuine fear that communism was a real threat to the American way of life, and that we couldn't allow secret communists to be writing movies or directing them because they didn't want the sort of these communist-leaning thoughts toward them. So you're going to be shut out. The interesting thing is that a lot of people are allowed to work under pseudonyms. For instance, we mentioned Dalton Trumbo, and he's going to be, this guy sort of pops up through this entire thing. He was a screenwriter, and after he does his year in jail, he moves to Mexico. And he actually, during this period of time where he's blacklisted, writes 30 movies under pseudonyms. And of course, there were people in the studio system who knew who was behind it, but there were a lot of people who were privately against this whole process but couldn't speak up publicly because they didn't want to get added to the list. So they're willing to help out these other people who are blacklisted by taking their movies and stuff and using various pseudonyms. And Trumbo actually is going to win 2 Oscars for screenwriting while writing under pseudonyms. He wrote the screenplay for Roman Holiday under a pseudonym, and he was actually posthumously awarded that Oscar in the 1980s, I think. And he also won the screenplay for The Brave One in 1956, also under a pseudonym. So obviously, you know, it's kind of a strange thing. Here's a guy who's allegedly not allowed to work who has won 2 Oscars.
How pervasive in Hollywood was the knowledge that this really was Dalton Trumbo and not, I mean, do you know how known it was that this was a pseudonym and not a real person or not the same person?
Well, there were a lot of rumors. And it's one of those things where at this period of time, you know, it's tough to separate fact from fiction. And so you get these instances where, okay, people will say, oh, okay, this screenwriter, this person wrote this under a pseudonym, and the director will just deny it all up and down until, you know, eventually the truth comes out much later. So it seems like, it's one of those things, of course, it's hard to tell who knew what when, right?
Right.
But it seems like there was a general knowledge that this kind of thing was going on, but that it wasn't necessarily widespread which movies were which. But obviously, look, if you write 30 films under a pseudonym, there are a lot of people who are going to know that this is going on. So it's not something that everybody is going to know, because otherwise it probably would have been solved. But it's certainly, people are going to have suspicions, and it's going to be difficult to prove it. I mean, and of course, it's really only screenwriters who are going to be able to work very easily under a pseudonym. A lot of this is because these people are living elsewhere and able to write screenplays from a distance. A lot of people simply left and went to other countries. Jules Dassin, for instance, who directed the great caper film Rififi in France, moved there because he was blacklisted and he just left America. It's interesting, of course, you hear his name, you think that he must be a European director, but he was, in fact, an American director who left America because he was not able to work after that. He was just pretty much just disgusted with the entire thing and so went to Europe and didn't return, really.
And he had to. It wasn't just like, I protest, and he left. He
right.
was going to starve if he stayed in the country.
Right. He had to find work elsewhere. So a lot of these people are going to just go to Europe, where the consideration is not going to be the same. There's not a blacklist in Europe. But the European film industry is much smaller than the American one. Hollywood really dominates during this period of time, so you're not going to have as much money to work with. You're not going to get paid as much. You're not going to get the same international success. And, a lot of people just can't up and move their families. And it's going to be really tough, for instance, if you're someone who works in a lesser capacity behind the screens. If you're a set decorator or costume designer or something and you get blacklisted, you're going to be probably hosed. You can't just up and leave the country necessarily because you're probably not a super rich kind of person that has all that money. You're going to just go find a new line of work, and this happens to a lot of people. Another person definitely worth mentioning is the director Elia Kazan, the director who did cooperate and did name names. Very, very famously, he directed the film On the Waterfront, the great film with Marlon Brando, which is sort of his defense of cooperation. It's a film about corrupt unions and about standing up and about going against and even sort of like ratting on your friends. I mean, it's not very veiled if you know the history. And of course, On the Waterfront is a great film, but it's always been sort of controversial in Hollywood because there were a lot of people who were friends with people that Kazan named, and when Kazan won his honorary Oscar, there were a lot of people who famously refused to applaud for him. He kind of became kind of a shunned person after the blacklisting era ended in Hollywood, because a lot of people were just disgusted that he cooperated.
Not just that, but he never apologized. Some people, there's a lot of people that named names, but a lot of people would apologize afterward, and I think people were more sympathetic about that, but Kazan never did.
He was steadfast that he did the right thing, that he was one of the people who believed that communism in the 1940s posed a real threat and that we should have cooperated. So that was definitely one of the things that he was controversial for. And Carl Foreman, a writer and producer, is another person who got blacklisted for basically refusing to deal with this. And it's interesting because he got blacklisted right about the time that the film he wrote, High Noon, was going into production. And High Noon is sort of a veiled attack on this whole McCarthyism era. His name, I don't believe, it actually appeared on High Noon. It was removed as it was going into production because he got blacklisted just at that time. In fact, just to diverge for a second, it got so extreme that if you wrote a screenplay before you were blacklisted and they filmed the screenplay, they wouldn't credit you. If you wrote a story or something in the 30s or you wrote a movie and it's being remade, they wouldn't credit you because the industry was so obsessed with seeming like it was doing everything that it could to prevent any communist sympathizers to deal with this. They completely just whitewashed everyone away. So High Noon, though, is sort of the opposite of On the Waterfront. It's about a man who stands up and finds all of his friends just completely abandon him. Foreman was apparently really disgusted with the notion that the intellectuals and the elite in American society didn't do more to deal with this Red Scare. And Foreman's another guy who's going to win an Oscar for writing under a pseudonym for the script for Bridge on the River Kwai. He wrote it with another blacklisted writer, actually, Michael Wilson, who they shared the Oscar. They wrote it under a pseudonym. So we have two more blacklisted guys winning Oscars at this point in time for wonderful screenplays. And the system is going to sort of end once again with Dalton Trumbo, the Blacklist. It's going to really start petering out in the late 1950s, in part because the Red Scare itself is going to die down, and in part because people do start standing up to it. Very famous example that was just recently made into Good Night and Good Luck about Edward R. Murrow and sort of the attack on McCarthy himself. And there's this point in time where the country sort of said, enough of this, we can't handle this. And everyone sort of decided that we had gone a little too far, and so the Red Scare kind of died down, and people were begin to start working again. And Dalton Trumbo was going to be the first guy to begin getting credited once again, and that's in 1960 for the film Spartacus. So he's going to be credited for that, and also right about that same time, the film Exodus by Otto Preminger. He's going to receive credit for that as well, though actually Spartacus is released first. He was announced as the writer publicly for Exodus prior to his being announced as being the screenwriter for Spartacus, but Spartacus is released first, so people tend to cite Spartacus as the first film to feature someone coming back off the blacklist. And really, right about that point in time, the early 60s, it's going to be dead forever. Another interesting thing that sort of ended this was a guy named John Henry Falk was a radio host who got blacklisted by one of these sort of groups that was maintaining list of potential communists. And he got blacklisted and sued in 1957. He said, look, you can't just say that I'm a communist and deprive me of work. I'm going to sue you. And he was actually just pretty much, as far as we can tell, one of the only people to actually sue one of these groups for it. He says, you're causing me loss of work. You're saying these things that aren't true about me. so you need to pay me money. And, you know, that kind of became a huge deal at the time in 1957 when he did that. And he'll eventually win his case, though it won't happen until 1962. And really, at that point in time, these groups just go away because we can't just suddenly start implying that all these people are communists and you shouldn't hire them because it's going to hurt our bottom line. And so really, by the time the 1960s roll around, the blacklist is fortunately over and done with. One interesting side note I'd like to mention is that this is a period in time that Hollywood has almost completely failed to address directly. There are a bunch of movies that were made during this time that sort of talk about it in veiled metaphor and that kind of thing, but I can't think of a single Hollywood film that deals directly with the blacklist. There are movies that deal with McCarthyism, but Hollywood seems to be, I mean, this is really one of Hollywood's darkest moments, and I don't think anyone in the industry really wants to bring this up again.
It's really weird that there hasn't, you'd think that somebody, especially we have a new generation or two even since then of people in Hollywood, and you think, yeah, let's rally against whatever injustice, you'd think there'd be a lot of people who would be interested in making those kinds of movies, but really don't. There's all these exceptions. Like in 1976, I guess, it was billed as the first movie to deal seriously with the blacklist, and that was called The Front, starring Woody Allen, but one of the movies that he didn't write or direct. He was just the star in it. And it was a comedy, supposedly a satire about, he plays this guy who serves as the front for a number of blacklisted screenwriters, and so he submits their screenplays as his own. And it's a funny movie, but I don't know that it really has the bite of a satire. And then there's all these other things like The Way We Were that definitely deal with what it was like to be in Hollywood at this time, but again, I don't know that there's really an editorial about the time or anything like that. You'd think there'd be more.
Right, we get like Good Night and Good Luck, and Hollywood's fine to go after McCarthy all the time in movies that take place during this period in time, but very little about the people in Hollywood who enabled this. I mean, the blacklist could not have worked without the cooperation of the studios. I don't believe that the United States Congress ever actually made it illegal to hire communists. They just put a lot of pressure on it, and these studios really just folded and started cooperating before really pursuing legal action.
And it really did affect a lot of people. I mean, we talked about the Hollywood 10, but the blacklist itself...
There were hundreds.
At least, I'd say 150 or somewhere in there. And it was sometimes people that were very well known. I mean, Dashiell Hammett, Leonard Bernstein, the composer, Judy Holliday, Lena Horne, Burl Ives. That's just a few I'm looking at on this list. On our website, allmovietalk.com. Oh, Edward G. Robinson is here, a very, very famous star. But on our website, we'll post a link to the Wikipedia page, or you can just go there yourself, and the Hollywood Blacklist has a very good history and the list of people.
We're always looking for the new stars, and today it seems like we hear about them before we ever see the movies they're in. I mean, just recently I remember Sienna Miller in Factory Girls being touted as the next, you know, as should be an Academy Award winning performance, and she's the next big star, and I guess she had been in some things before that, but, you know, the hype seemed to have peaked before the movie came out and then didn't really make much of a splash. And so let's see, sometimes somebody is touted in that way and they do end up being popular, but, you know, it's just strange how quickly somebody's fame is determined, whether or not they're going to be successful and famous and everything. But I have a trivia question about somebody whose stardom didn't really hit until his 80th film, 80. His 80th film was his breakthrough performance, and then he went on to make movies for something like, you know, four more decades after that. And this is, we're talking about one of the biggest stars in history. Question is, can you think of who I'm talking about and maybe even identify what the breakthrough role was? We'll get back to it at the end of the show.
Our top six list this week is going to be the top six rock and roll movies, and I picked this topic myself, and then when I sat down to compile a list of the rock and roll movies that I really like, it turns out, I don't know, I don't really like that many. I had eight, I guess, at a stretch and chopped out two. What'd you think of this one, Steven? Is this the right genre for you or not?
Not really. I'm honestly not that much of a music buff, so, you know, I haven't seen a lot of the great concert films or documentaries and stuff, so yeah, it was kind of tough for me as well.
So this is going to be a top six segment for people who, for once, don't know what they're talking about.
For once.
Except for me. I know what I'm talking about. Number six for me is going to be Jailhouse Rock. It's an obligatory pick. I got to pick it because that's, you know, it's obligatory, and that's what that means. Elvis Presley's first movie, made in 1957, and about a guy who goes to jail for manslaughter and winds up becoming a rock star while in jail. A bit of an edge to it compared to what you might think or remember, or especially if you've seen Elvis Presley's later movies. This one is a bit edgy to it, hard-hitting, and it plays to that stereotype of rock and roll people being rebels of some way. But, you know, great music, that's all you can really ask for a great rock and roll movie, so that's my number six pick.
Okay, yeah, that's not really that good of a movie, though, so I'm kind of surprised you I didn't pick any of the Elvis movies.
It's good music.
Okay, well, I also am having the requirement that it has to be a good movie to make my list, so...
This is a good... All right, whatever. Go ahead.
Well, like I said, I'm not picking necessarily straight musical-type movies. I've picked some that I think capture the rock and roll spirit. That's why my number six pick is True Romance, the 1993 Tony Scott film starring Christian Slater as a sort of unwilling kind of gangster sort who is obsessed with Elvis to the point where he talks to him on a regular basis. And Val Kilmer plays Elvis, who I think, as you know, point out in your pick, is sort of the epitome of rock and roll in a lot of ways. And it's a movie that has a very rock and roll feel to it, even if rock isn't sort of the central theme of it. I mean, look, any movie where the guy's main idol is Elvis and he talks regularly to Elvis, that's got to be a sort of rock and roll flick. And it's a pretty good action film with a really solid script by Quentin Tarantino and all sorts of great cameos and a really fun movie. Not my favorite, but a movie I do enjoy and recommend.
Neat pick. I like that. My number five is a bit more traditional, and half of you, possibly Stephen, I don't know, are going to be slapping your foreheads, but I liked it, and I'm not ashamed of it. I liked That Thing You Do, the movie from 1996, directed by Tom Hanks, of all people, and it's about a fictional rock band that is pretty similar to the Beatles, except that this particular group, called the Wonders, is a one-hit wonder. Get it? Wonders. Anyway, the great thing about this, besides that the title song is really catchy and kind of fun, is that it gets a lot of the period details correct. It really does feel like the mentality of the 60s, not just the superficial elements, like the clothing and the manner of speech and everything. It really does feel like this is a story that came out of the 60s, and that's a lot of fun. It was probably quite the nostalgia trip for Tom Hanks to make it, and I think that comes across.
You know, I don't really like That Thing You Do that much, but I can certainly see why you would, and I agree with what you say about it feeling very authentic, though. And while I like the song, I read a review of it pretty recently because I think they just got re-released on DVD, and the reviewer pointed out that this is a movie where the fake songs are actually good, which is something that's not often the case, you know, when you see these sort of movies that are fictional accounts of whatever. A lot of times, these songs that become hits are actually songs that would never become hits. The one-hit song in That Thing You Do is actually a pretty decent song, even if it does get played way, way too much during the course of that film that you become kind of sick of it. But I guess that goes along with the whole one-hit wonder thing. Yeah, not a bad movie. Well, my number five pick is another not quite exactly musical movie, though it does feature a great musical moment as a group of friends burst out singing along with Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody, and of course I'm talking about Wayne's World from 1992, directed by Penelope Spheeris. I mean, this is one of the very, very few good movies to result from an SNL sketch becoming a feature film, but this is a great film. I mean, in a lot of ways, I really do think it's kind of underrated. People just think it's a dumb, silly comedy, which it is, of course, but it's a really good, dumb, silly comedy that really captures the early 90s and that kind of slacker attitude better than a lot of the more serious sort of slacker Gen X movies from that time did. And of course, just great music and tons of fun, awesome musical cameos.
Yeah, I'm not a big Wayne's World fan, but, you know, again, I agree with what you're saying about it because it did capture that mentality, but I don't know. I think that you have to be either a Bill and Ted fan or a Wayne's World fan, and maybe you like both, but you definitely always prefer one or the other. You just can't like both equally. That's my theory. I'm sticking with it. Number four, we're going to go back in time a bit more again to 1963, and the movie is Bye Bye Birdie, a musical that is just so funny at lampooning the rock star image. The character is called Conrad Birdie, and that's a takeoff of the name of the country star, Conway Twitty, but the actual character character itself is obviously, you know, it's Elvis Presley, very thinly disguised, but it just exaggerates everything so wonderfully. I mean, he comes out and he kind of does a little shake of his hips and just an entire college's worth of girls faint, and they're just lying all over the park and they are unconscious because, oh wow, it was Conrad Birdie. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have the older generation that just doesn't know what these kids are up to. What's the matter with kids today is one of the musical numbers that's really funny. It's got by Paul Lynde, very great comedian but underrated, and Dick Van Dyke's in it, and it's just a great hodgepodge of fun things that makes fun of the whole generation gap and the difference in music from you know, the older generation and then the emerging rock and roll genre.
Yeah, a pick I kind of considered, but once again, just one of those ones where I'm not a huge fan of, but I kind of expected you to have picked it, so not bad. Well, my number four pick is, I think, a movie we've talked about before, and heck, it's a movie that helped inspire us to have to do these top six lists when they did top five, and that's High Fidelity from 2000 by director Stephen Frears, a great story starring John Cusack and Jack Black, and boy, I have a sneaking suspicion that Jack Black is going to play a factor in one of your later picks, Sam, but we'll see if I'm right when I get there. But just a cool movie about guys who work in a music store and take pop and rock way too seriously. And a great movie just about obsessiveness and how really, really being into whatever it is, music. You know, as someone who's a little bit too into movies, I can absolutely relate. But just how that can really capture your life and the trivia of it. And really good film with lots of great music. A really killer soundtrack with lots of kind of, you know, underrated musicians and artists and bands and stuff. A really fun movie, and I imagine that if you're more of a music buff, that it's even more fun.
High Fidelity is a pretty good movie, yes, but you like it more than I do, and I knew you'd pick it, so I didn't have to. We're playing that game again. We're just trying to anticipate each other. And number three for me, it's a more of a subtle pick here. It has more to do with the mentality and the scene rather than the actual music itself, and the movie is American Graffiti from 1973, directed by George Lucas before he made a little movie called Star Wars, but this is where he got his start. And, well, I mean, it's a teenage kind of a movie. High school graduates, they're spending a night on the town before they go off to college, and it's a very glamorized kind of nostalgic view of this period. It kind of feels like Happy Days did about the 50s, except this was about the 60s, but it has that kind of feel to it. It even has, actually, Harrison Ford in a very, very early role, just in a quick scene, but it's hard to describe it and describe why it works. It just feels like a real experience, a real human experience, and a movie that understands something about going through that period in life that most movies, if they address it all, really only just say the words. They don't play the music. Anyway, a lot of great rock and roll music on the soundtrack. It's just endless great, great songs from the classic period of rock and roll, so I think that's why it fits in here so nicely.
Absolutely, a nice, solid pick. And my number three choice is probably something a lot of people would have as their number one. It's a movie that I like, but maybe I don't love it as much as others do, and that is This Is Spinal Tap from 1984 by director Rob Reiner, back when Rob Reiner was just a great director. I don't know what the heck happened to him, but of course, I mean, probably if you're listening to this, you know of and have likely seen Spinal Tap, but it's one of the early sort of mockumentaries focusing around a rock band that plays, as we follow them on this tour of their new album, and as the tour progresses, they play in smaller and smaller venues and have just these ridiculous mishaps, including very, very famously and very humorously, there's this part where they're going to sing this song about Stonehenge, and they expect a giant, 10-foot-tall slab of rock to come descending from the ceiling, and what they get is the size of Stonehenge when they were shown the model and okayed it. So this little tiny, you know, foot-tall Stonehenge as they're trying to be all cool and mystical, singing around it. Just tons and tons of great kind of that sort of improvisational humor. Christopher Guest is in this, so if you're a fan of those other Christopher Guest movies like Best in Show or A Mighty Wind or something, very similar kind of humor. Just a great film, and also really good music that's also pretty funny. The Spinal Tap songs are all sort of novelty songs, but they're also pretty decent rock songs, too, and it's just a lot of fun.
You know, you mentioned the High Fidelity earlier with the top five list, but I meant to point out at the time, you know, ours go to six.
Yeah, exactly.
It's one more. Yeah, that was my number two pick, and I was really expecting your pick of This is Spinal Tap, because I knew you'd have it, to be higher up than mine at number two, but okay, mine's number two, and yeah, I don't think all the scenes in the movie work. It's kind of a grab bag, and I think the movie is much better in memory when you're only really remembering the great parts to it, and you kind of forget about the sequences that don't quite work, but there's a lot of really great creativity here, and you can see how they were having a lot of fun making it, and, you know, some of it turned out better than others, but overall, a very, very great, funny movie.
Well, it didn't get higher on my list just because I had two other movies that I had to put above it, including my number two pick, which is one of my personal favorite movies, a movie that really, really speaks to me on a personal level for a lot of reasons, and that's Almost Famous by Cameron Crowe from 2000, the pseudo-autobiographical story about a kid, you know, basically based on Crowe's life, who goes on to be a Rolling Stone reporter before he even graduates from high school. He's like 15 or 16 at the time and touring with this fictional band. And it's such a wonderful movie that really celebrates sort of the end of the classic rock and roll era right in the early 70s as rock is changing and disco's on the horizon, and you know, there's the whole glam rock thing that's becoming really popular. It's a wonderful movie about watching this kid as he comes of age and realizes that his idols may not be exactly the way he thinks they are, but still, it's an optimistic and hopeful movie, and I think it's Crowe's best, and I'm a big fan of Cameron Crowe. And just also, you know, of course we talk about great soundtracks. Cameron Crowe can pick better soundtracks than I think anybody else out there. Obviously, the guy's a huge music buff, and wow, just constantly, from, you know, start to end, great, great music. And if you watch the DVD, there is a wonderful deleted scene that some people really hate, but it's all about Stairway to Heaven. And if Crowe could have got the rights, he would have had an entire scene, people spinning, you know, how long is that song run for? 7 minutes? Sitting around listening to Stairway to Heaven, which would have been a great gag on the audience. But, oh well, there you go. Still a great film.
Well, I feel like we're having the same feedback for each other's picks throughout. Again, I'm going to say that I didn't really click with this one as much as you did, but again, I'm going to say that I can appreciate how this movie could be related to on a pretty personal level, and I do think it does speak to a lot of people and deserves respect for that. So I'm going to just replay that clip every time. I don't know. Well, my number one, see, I don't know if I matched your number one or not, because I can think of two movies that you might have put as your number one, and of course maybe you surprised me and did a third, but my number one is going to be A Hard Day's Night by the Beatles. It's perhaps the only great rock and roll musical, just in that traditional format, and it's pretty much a day in the life of the Beatles after they became popular, but before they became too jaded. It's just a sense that the Beatles at this time were taking their fame in stride and the lifestyle changes that it wrought upon them in stride, but they weren't necessarily really reveling in it and being arrogant about it, as you might think. I mean, in fact, it's almost oppressive, their fame and just immediate popularity. There's a sequence that's really quite interesting where one of them goes off on his own, just takes off and tries to find an empty place that can be quiet and not constantly fawned over and directed. And the other thing that's interesting about this movie is the generation gap. Very visible. We got these stars who are young men, and they're in a world that is still run by the generation before that, doesn't really approve of their tremendously long hairstyles and their subversive lyrics and everything. People who want them to be at a certain place on time for this type of thing. It's just a very ordered type of life that this older generation wants to impose upon the Beatles, or at least that's the way they see it, and the movie is told from that perspective. So I think there's probably a little selective sight going on when you're taking a look at these two generations, but that is very evident. And the feeling I like about this movie is the feeling of freedom. It's a weird comparison, but it actually reminds me a lot of the work of François Truffaut that we've talked about before, the Antoine Doinel movies that are all about freedom and one guy trying to be free of the society that would constrain him in some way. And, you know, it just sounds like such a hippie kind of attitude. I'm not sure that I necessarily have the same desires that these characters have, but, you know, I appreciate that feeling, and I think that really connects in a way that just cuts through and around all the actual issues at stake about what is the place of society and family and an individual and all that. So, great movie for evoking a feeling, for portraying a society, and just great, again, great, great music.
Yeah, how did you think I could pick any other movie from number one? I mean, A Hard Day's Night just stands head and shoulders above every other rock movie out there, I think. I agree with pretty much everything Sam just said about it. Maybe one thing worth mentioning is the wonderful photography in this film, too. Just brilliant black and white photography by director Richard Lester. Just, it's a gorgeous movie to look at. I think sometimes, you know, you talk about the great feeling of freedom, which is probably the most memorable takeaway from the movie, and of course, that wonderful sort of early Beatles music. I actually prefer, you know, a little bit later Beatles type stuff, but, you know, the early stuff is still great, and here it's put on display. But, you know, this is a really, really well directed movie. I think sometimes, you know, the Beatles themselves get all the credit for it, but this was probably a pretty difficult movie to direct in a lot of ways. It has a very improvisational type feel to it, but it's not all improv. It was scripted, and it feels absolutely like a documentary in a lot of ways. I mean, it's not quite a mockumentary in the way that this is Spinal Tap is or something, but it definitely has that exact same kind of vibe, and it has the look, and just a wonderful film, and also, maybe something the Sam didn't make clear, is that it's ridiculously funny.
Yeah.
It's not a sort of serious movie. I mean, you can talk and definitely take a lot out of it. There's a lot built into it, a very layered movie, but it's just a really good time. This is absolutely a great comedy and a heck of a lot of fun, and holds up really well today. So yeah, my number one pick is also Hard Day's Night from 1964 by Richard Lester.
I love the British understatement humor. That's really nice in this especially. Yeah, the other movie I was thinking of that I really wanted to pick, but yeah, I've talked about it a lot, Moulin Rouge. Has all kinds of great rock tunes, but the reason I disqualified it for myself is that the renditions aren't really rock and roll style. It kind of takes those tunes and...
Moulin Rouge is not a rock movie, man.
Yeah.
Okay, so I have two questions. One, how did neither of us pick the Blues Brothers? Oh, man, people are gonna rip us on that one. And two, how did you not pick School of Rock? I thought for sure that was going to be on your list. Otherwise, I would have picked it.
That was one of the eight, and I just I cut one because, in part, I had picked it for a previous top six.
Are you kidding?
Like,
you took
so
that thing
I'm
you do
again,
over
you know?
School of Rock?
Yeah, sure.
All right.
Sure.
Okay.
Why not?
It's your choice.
All right, let's recap. Our lists are not as popular with each other as they sometimes are. Well, anyway, my number six, Jailhouse Rock. Number five, That Thing You Do. Number four, Bye Bye Birdie. Number three, American Graffiti. Number two, This Is Spinal Tap. And number one, Hard Day's Night.
And my top six rock and roll movies. Number six, True Romance from 1993 by Tony Scott. Number five, Wayne's World, 1992 by Penelope Spheris. Number four, The Great High Fidelity from the year 2000 by director Stephen Frears. Number three, Rob Reiner's This Is Spinal Tap from 1984. Number two, Cameron Crowe's film Almost Famous from 2000. And number one, Sam and I agree on this placement, A Hard Day's Night from 1964 by Richard Lester.
For the last many weeks, we've been talking about animation in some form or another, and I'm going to wrap it up by talking about Hayao Miyazaki, who's considered by many to be the greatest living animator, as Japanese animator. And, you know, if you don't know a whole lot about anime, then maybe, you know, kind of distinguish this in your mind. Miyazaki's films have the superficial look of a lot of the things that the other Japanese animation does, but, you know, I think if you sat down and watched it, you'd have a very different reaction to what you think anime is, and so that's one of the reasons I want to do this segment, because I see where they're coming from, calling him the greatest living animator. He has a great, wonderful vision. I mean, all his films are great, pretty much. And they're just a great, mostly children's movies, but they work as well for adults. I've seen all of them as an adult, and I love them. So let's talk a bit about Miyazaki. Well, first of all, Stephen, let me just get your take on Miyazaki's work, because I know you like it too.
Well, I like it. I don't know... It's hard to say, you know, give me a take on a director's work. But no, I think what probably makes him what makes him really interesting is the way he can sort of tread this weird line between adult stuff and more children-oriented fare. Of the movies of his that I've seen, I think they, for the most part, be appropriate for older children. You know, something like Totoro is sort of all ages appropriate. But they still really appeal to adults in a way that the best animated movies do. And unlike, you know, some of the other Japanese anime stuff, this isn't fake stuff for adults. This isn't, you know, for teenage boys that people claim is adult because it has lots of violence in it. These are actually interesting stories about people, and, you know, they kind of remind me, you know, especially something like, obviously, Spirited Away is deliberately reminiscent of a classic children's book. They remind me of the way that classic children's literature is still worth reading as an adult. You still, it takes you back to childhood, to the things you thought about, to the fantastic and the amazing, and I just love that. I think certainly Miyazaki is just great at really capturing that sort of fantastic idea of imagination and wonder that's so interesting in the movies.
Yeah, and it's also worth noting that a lot of his main characters are children, and that's very deliberate, because children are discovering the world from a new perspective. They don't have a lot of baggage that they're carrying with them. They're not old and jaded. They're able to observe wondrous things with wonder, and I think that's a real key ingredient in a lot of his movies. So I have a few themes. I just jotted down what I thought kind of, I don't know if they add up to, you know, if you take all these different themes I'm going to talk about and you add them up and then you get Miyazaki. I think there's more to it than that, but certainly there are things that he keeps returning to again and again, and those are definitely worth talking about. And one of them, the first one that came to mind, was flight. I think Miyazaki is just absolutely fascinated with flying, and that fascination, I mean, it has to be a real-life thing, that because that experience that he has, he brings to the animation. I don't think there are other movies, just in general, that convey the sense of flight in such a compelling way, an invigorating way. You get a sense of the height and freedom, and you get a sense of gravity and air currents working on you, and you get the sense of just how wonderful it is to be able to see the world below you, and the sound of the wind whipping past you, and all these different things really drive home. And they're in most of his movies. I mean, in Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind, there's these characters flying on little open-air machines, and Kiki's Delivery Service is about a little girl witch flying on a broom. Porco Rosso is about a World War I flying ace that tracks down pirates in the air. And then other movies that aren't as thematically tied to flying still have it in there. Spirited Away has some. My Neighbor Totoro has this flying bus. And then a couple movies, Laputa, Castle in the Sky, and Howl's Moving Castle, all about these big giant castles that fly. So I think it's pretty clear it's not just an accidental use of the same themes over and over again. He's obviously fascinated by flight, and particularly in Nausicaa, I think, it's just such a great sensation that the movie is able to give you of flying. And I wish I'd seen these on the big screen, actually. I saw most of these, I guess, on a small screen, and I still got that dazzling big screen kind of feeling out of it, just because the animation and sound was such a standout and so good.
Yeah, though you know what, you're right, they absolutely do play better on a big screen. I remember I saw Princess Mononoke first on like a bootleg VHS copy before it had been released in the United States, and I thought, oh, it's a pretty interesting movie, it was pretty good. And then I saw it in the theater when it came out, and I was just blown away by how wonderful it is. So if you get the chance, unfortunately, you know, we haven't really gotten very wide releases for these movies, you know, wider than a lot of imported anime, but yeah, definitely Miyazaki plays much better on the big screen than on the small screen, though, yeah, I still enjoy watching his movies on my television.
Yeah. Okay, so another theme that may be a bit more meaty is that he keeps seeming to come back to is stuff about the ecology, the world environment, and the way the world interacts with itself in harmony or in opposition, in the ways that that harmony can be disrupted. So usually he portrays this in a pretty fantastical kind of way. I mean, you're not going to be watching An Inconvenient Truth with Hayao Miyazaki. It's embedded into the stories, and it's just kind of one of the themes he plays with. These great creatures or spirits kind of representing the voice of the world. And I think Nausicaä, again, is the best example of this. You have this post-apocalyptic world, a world that has destroyed itself in war, and now we're in the middle of the healing process, and humanity is just trying to find its place in the new world. The Earth is developing these new ecological systems to try to regain its balance, and sort of what's developing are these two different ecologies at odds with each other. They call it the Sea of Decay, and it's just this terrible forest area that where you're not sure what's going on in there, but it's a dangerous place to go, and everybody tries to stay away from it, but they don't know much about it. And sure enough, of course, eventually a couple of the characters wind up there and are able to explore and see what's actually happening there and meet the creatures that inhabit this world. And it's pretty fascinating because in a way it's not as fearsome of a place as everybody thought it was, and in another way it's even more fearsome. I mean, there's a real sense of danger that the world is going to not be able to recover, but maybe it will. And the characters get to understand this foreign world. And in other movies of his, you can see ecological matters as well. My Neighbor Totoro, definitely. Princess Mononoke. Spirited Away has this great, great scene, my favorite scene in the movie, with this big, humongous creature full of mud and trash and stink and everything. And he comes to this bathhouse where the movie takes place to take a bath. And you wouldn't think that'd be your favorite scene in a movie, but and you definitely wouldn't think it would be suspenseful and exciting and dramatic and visually creative and everything and trippy and... But it is. And at the end of the scene, we actually figure out what was really happening there. It's just sort of a situation where you have this weird Alice in Wonderland trippy kind of visual adventure, and then at the end, oh, actually it did make sense, at least in a thematic way. And so that's one of the reasons I found it so fascinating, but it is definitely tied to matters of the ecology.
Yeah, that's a pretty common theme in Japanese culture and literature and movies and stuff, but you know, I think Miyazaki handles it really, really well, too. I think you see this theme a lot. Okay, here's a great example. Do you remember that crappy, crappy children's movie called Fern Gully that was that American animated film from the 90s, which like tries to tackle this idea, in which it was like the evil creature was like some sort of giant tree destroyer thing that was possessed. Oh god, I hate that movie. Anyway, you know, that's like the bad way to do this, where you have all of civilization and industry as being pure evil, and you know, the creatures in the forest just wonderful happy hippies that live in harmony with everything. That's just annoying. You know, the Japanese view of things tends to be a little less like this, but it can I mean, there's definitely like, you can find anime or video games from Japan that have this same theme, just as annoying as Fern Gully or something crappy like that. But Miyazaki really, I think, does an interesting job of not hitting you repeatedly as hard as he can over the head with this. And, you know, civilization and industry aren't portrayed as being these terrible evils in his films either. They're just, you know, these opposing things, and he's always sort of arguing there's some sort of balance between them. And I've always liked that about his movies versus some others.
I think one of the reasons it's not quite so annoying as those others that you mentioned is that he's not really preaching an answer. He's raising a question and kind of exploring some of the ramifications of what we do to the environment, but he's not really saying, okay, we have a problem here, we need to fix it, and this is, you know, this is how we fix it, and this is what we should do, we should get rid of everything that, pollutes or whatever, I don't know. We simplify the environment. The truth is, the environment is a very complex thing, and when you start factoring in, well, where does society fit in, where does humanity fit in, where does technology and other things factor into this problem, you get something that is just huge. There are no simple answers, I'm sorry. But these movies, you know, they address the issue without talking down and trying to simplify it and saying, hey, I know what it's all about. Nobody knows what it's all about. This movie is simply exploring the situation and does it in a way that's very character and story oriented. So, it's not even like it's a peripheral thing. It's very embedded in the stories that are being told. Another factor, machinery. And we talked about the ecology. Now let's talk about machinery, because he is fascinated with machinery as well. Loves these complex, maybe even Rube Goldberg devices, I guess. probably Howl's Moving Castle is the most dramatic example of this one. This big castle that floats around everywhere. It looks like this giant Rube Goldberg device with gears and levers sticking out everywhere and big pumps and pistons and sounds and gears grinding and I don't know. Just, I don't know what all these things do, but it's a marvel in terms of the visuals and just conveying the sense of awe of a machinery this big and that is working to maintain this place. And there's always some mysterious guy closeted away somewhere that's in charge of keeping the machinery running. I love the boiler room in Spirited Away, which has this guy who is these little enchanted balls of soot working for him. Hey, if you ever doubt that animation can show you absolutely anything and make it believable and fun, just remember, Spirited Away has enchanted balls of soot that are some of the coolest characters ever. I mean, and if you wonder why people call Miyazaki the greatest living animator, look at the animation on these enchanted balls of soot. It's just, what a way to capture the imagination there. And finally, I guess, I mean, there are many themes that Miyazaki deals with, but the fourth one that is most compelling to me is the way he deals with mystery in the characters. For example, in My Neighbor Totoro, this guy Totoro is not a very expressive character. He's just kind of a big lump of something or other with eyes, and those eyes are just kind of big and round. It doesn't have a lot of facial expressions. You think of a lot of Disney animation, which is, you know, it's good. This isn't a criticism. It's just a different style. Disney can... famous for making teacups and brooms and I don't know what, have a very expressive nature to them. Inanimate objects that you wouldn't think would have any personality at all, and they are imbued with great personality. But here's something that is, you know, vaguely animal-shaped and alive and has anatomical features and is not expressive. And yet, that's still compelling, too, because eventually, over the course of the movie, you get to know that character, and you get to understand who he is, and then eventually you can start interpreting his minimalistic body language and behavior and understand what he's thinking and feeling. And by the end of the movie, Totoro, this character that you have met and been a little apprehensive about because it seems so reserved and powerful, but you don't know what his agenda is and what he's going to do, by the end of the movie, you absolutely love this character. It's really amazing how that works. It's very subtle. It's a difficult thing to do in the movies to be able to have that large of an emotional kind of a journey without any real huge dramatic key points to drive the development forward. It's just a gradual type of thing where we meet this thing that's, you know, not very expressive, and then we learn how to understand it anyway. That's amazing. And then the other thing we see in the way he handles characters is that they have motivations that aren't necessarily clear-cut. You get people that look like villains, for example, and either they are not really villains, or maybe they are, but there's some sort of compensation to it, where the character is actually fulfilling a real good role in some other capacity. You rarely have a clear division of good and evil in Miyazaki's works. I dug up a really interesting quote from him, and that is that the concept of portraying evil and then destroying it, I know this is considered mainstream, but I think it is rotten. This idea that whenever something evil happens, someone particular can be blamed and punished for it in life and in politics is hopeless. What an interesting perspective, and it kind of puts his take on the ecology in perspective, too. You can't just identify a target for blame and then eliminate it and expect everything to be okay. It's a more of a complex issue. And so you see, you know, for example, the villainess in Spirited Away, maybe not such an evil character, and maybe other characters are good, but then there's something a little suspicious about them. They're real mysterious, and you some of the journey in watching a Miyazaki film is to kind of unravel that mystery as best you can, but they're rarely just clear-cut cardboard kind of answers. We're almost done. Almost time for All Movie Talk to pack it in for another week, but we're going to get back to the trivia question at the beginning of the show, talking about a star who did not hit it big until his 80th film. Very unusual for somebody to take that long to become super famous. One of the biggest stars in the world, Steven, do you know who I'm talking about?
Is it This is a trick question. Is it an animated character?
That's a very good question, but no. This is a real person, and 40-year career or so at the.
I'm gonna guess 80 films. I'm gonna guess it's a silent actor. So I'm gonna go with. What about Chaplin?
Chaplin, interesting guess, but no, he was actually quite popular very early on, like, you know, I don't know, 1915 or something like that.
Earlier, I think.
Yeah.
But, I mean,
yeah,
they made, like, earlier. You know, a movie took an hour to shoot back then.
I don't know, for all I know, maybe he did make 80 movies that were all... No, but we're talking about somebody who is a little bit later than this. He did start in silence, but I don't know if, you know, he's not really known for being in silence at all. You know, his the height of his popularity is probably in the 50s and maybe even into the 60s. Would it help if I suggested that he's a star of Westerns?
Star of Westerns who became popular in the 50s and the 60s?
Well, no, that was a height. He became popular maybe the 40s, let's say.
Well, probably John Wayne.
Yes, John Wayne, absolutely. His 80th movie was made in 1939 by John Ford. You know what that was?
Stagecoach.
Yeah, Stagecoach, right. 80th movie. He'd been in this huge string of B-movies where he wasn't actually really that good. In some cases, he was the lead actor, and he just became kind of stuck in this rut of being a B-movie actor. And so the producers didn't want him for this big A-list movie. They wanted people like Gary Cooper or Bruce Cabot or, I don't know, who knows. But John Ford really campaigned hard for John Wayne. And finally got him. And then he was really hard on him because he didn't want John Wayne to be intimidated acting alongside these other, you know, great, brilliant actors like Thomas Mitchell. You know, people who were great actors, but certainly you wouldn't think of the ordering as being like, the hierarchy as being that way around today. So, you know, he was second billed, second to Claire Trevor, who was the film's biggest star, but he was one of the least well-paid of the entire cast, and suddenly at film number 80, his stardom hit, and John Ford made many, many Westerns with him in it. That's it for episode 38, but join us on our website, allmovietalk.com. We've got a bunch of great things going on there that never make it to the podcast. And also, what never makes it to the podcast is rinkworks.com, rankworks.com, a movie checklist. If you want to see a lot of great movies, but you can't keep track of which ones to see, go to the Film Lovers Checklist. Thousands of movie reviews and other things. What do we got next week?
What we have next week is a show that is unquestionably great. We're going to be talking about ratings and censorship in the movies and the history of how all that works. And our top six list will be on political satires. So great movies about politics that are also funny and hopefully biting, sharp, and clever. So that'll all be there next week on June 26th at allmovietalk.com. And stop. No, I don't say cut. That's too pedestrian.